are symbolic of what we're talking about. Chair number one represents God sitting in the chair that controls our life. Chair number two is for others. And then chair number three, our seat, and that's the title of the series, I Am Third. And the question that we're really looking at is, who is sitting in chair number one in your life? Who is calling the shots? Who's making the decisions? And here's the big idea. A Christ-centered life puts God first, others second, and self third. Imagine walking into a formal banquet hall. Everybody is dressed to the hilts. Tables are decorated so fancy. I mean, the room is elegant. The tablecloths are perfect. Beautiful china, polished silverware, candlelight reflecting the crystal glasses, tuxedos and elegant gowns. But then all of a sudden, the host gets up, and he's the most honored person in the room, but he takes off his jacket, and he wraps a towel around his waist, and he stoops down to start washing people's feet. The room would probably maybe even gasp. What is going on? People would whisper. That moment, that captures the shock of the Christian life. The world says climb higher, but Jesus says kneel lower. In Mark 10:45, Jesus gives the defining statement of his mission. It says this, for even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. The King of the universe did not come demanding people to serve him, did not come demanding a throne to treat him the way he deserved to be treated. He came carrying a towel. He came to serve. Yet if we're honest, many of us hear this call to servanthood and our flesh pushes back. It says, who, me? A servant? You got to be kidding. Today we're going to uncover three truths about servanthood. But in order to become one who truly serves and puts others before us, we must first realize and overcome the resistance to serving. The resistance to serving. That's our first point. If serving is God's vision for us, why do we encounter resistance? Our natural instinct is to seek status, not servanthood. We want to be important. For example, look at Jesus' two disciples, James and John. Here's a peek at what was going on in their lives. Mark 10:35-37 says this. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. Teacher, they said, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. That statement just gets me. Can you imagine? Can you imagine going up to a very important leader, ruler, you know, some, and going up to him and saying, "We want you to do whatever we ask." that just strikes me. And then he goes on and says, Jesus said, "What do you want me to do for you?" He asked. Then they replied, "Let one of us sit at your right hand and the other at your left hand in glory." Now jump down to verse 41, and we see what the disciples have to say. It says, when the ten heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. See, James and John, they ask for the very best seats in heaven for eternity. They wanted the places of honor, one at the right and one at the left hand of Jesus. And the other disciples, it says, they were indignant. That's more than just a little bit upset. I mean, they were livid. They're really upset about this. But they don't seem to be upset for James and John that their minds are not quite in the right place and that they're seeking this status. No, they're not upset at them. They're upset because they didn't ask first. They want that seat. They're jealous. Jesus responds by given them two very different types of leadership models. First, he points out that the rulers of this world, they lord it over other people. And then he tells them, but in God's kingdom, the greatest are the servants. So why do we resist serving? Well, pride can whisper, that job's beneath you. Comparison whispers, somebody else should do it. Comfort whispers, it's not my concern. I'm not going to worry about it. Ease whispers, that's too difficult, and it's probably not going to make a difference anyway. And selfishness whispers, if I do that, I'll have to change my plans. We prefer applause to anonymity. Imagine a large corporate office. The CEO walks in one morning, and he notices trash on the floor. But instead of calling in the janitor to clean it up, he starts kneeling down. He picks up stuff and he grabs a broom and starts cleaning it up. Other employees walk in and they see him doing that and they're stunned. And some of them might even say, sir, you don't have to do that. But he says, if it needs done, it's worth doing. See, servanthood always surprises people because it contradicts the culture. In John chapter 13, we started talking about feet washing. That's the example of Jesus washing the disciples' feet. The job belonged to the very lowest household servant. It was someone else's job. It wasn't Jesus' job. But the roads were dusty. People wore open-toed shoes and their feet were filthy. It needed to be done. When Jesus came to Peter, remember what Peter said? No, Lord, you're not going to wash my feet. The translation, this isn't right. You're too important for this job. But Jesus is teaching something revolutionary. Greatness in God's kingdom is measured by humility, not by status, not by title, not talent or intelligence, by humility. Here's a few application questions for us. Are there tasks that I consider beneath me? Do I serve only when it's visible? Do I prefer recognition over responsibility? Servanthood begins when we surrender our need for status. Well, moving beyond the resistance to serving, next we come to the reality of serving. The reality of serving. Servanthood is not merely an attitude. It is an intentional, humble act. When Jesus washed the disciples' feet, he didn't just lecture on humility. He demonstrated it right there in front of them. John 13 describes that moment in vivid detail. Jesus stands up among them. He lays his outer garment aside. He takes up that towel. He fills up a basin. And then he deliberately, one by one, he starts washing their feet. The Creator of the world, who made oceans, pours water into a basin and begins to wash their feet. I mean, picture that scene. Can you imagine how awkward the disciples must have felt? Probably very silent, wondering what in the world is going on. What is Jesus doing? And as he moves from one disciple to another, James, and then Andrew, and then Matthew, and then he reaches Judas, and he knows what Judas is about to do, but yet he still stoops to serve and wash Judas's feet. Servanthood's not selective. Jesus didn't say, yeah, I'll wash yours, you deserve it, but you don't. Yeah, I know what you're going to do. He washed all their feet. Servanthood, we serve when it's inconvenient, when it's uncomfortable, when it's unappreciated, and even when it's undeserved. A pastor once told a story about a church member that arrived early every Sunday morning. Nobody thanked him. Nobody saw him. He came early to clean the bathrooms. That was his job. And when asked why he did it, he said, because every time I do, I remember Jesus washing feet. Now, we are so blessed. We're so blessed to be able to hire a cleaning service every week. And they do that, so we don't have to. But what if we couldn't? Would you come help clean the bathrooms? Servanthood often happens when nobody applauds. We find the biblical principle in Philippians 2, 3, and 4, where the Apostle Paul writes down some very difficult words for us to swallow. He says this, "Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit." Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. That's a tough one. "Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves." Hence the name, I am third, valuing others above ourselves, others second. "Not looking to your own interest, but each of you to the interest of others." Then the passage goes on to talk about Jesus. In your relationship with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself, becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Jesus existed in the form of God, in the comfort and the glory of heaven, but he gave it all up to come to the earth. Something tells me that if Jesus was at one of our potluck dinners, he wouldn't be looking through the dessert and grabbing the best one. I think he probably would see if maybe there's somebody that hadn't tried what he knew was going to be one of the best ones, taking it over to them and said, "Hey, if you haven't tried this, I highly recommend it. It's pretty amazing." Jesus took the form of a servant, and he became obedient to death, even death on the cross. The actions of Jesus, it defines the Christian life. It's about what the Christian life is all about. For us, servanthood might look like helping somebody without being asked, meeting a need quietly, doing unseen work faithfully, serving people who cannot pay you, and giving others the very first choice. One person anonymously said, "Servanthood is love wearing work clothes." That's a good one. I like that. Well, now that we've considered the resistance to serving and the reality of serving, let's look at the amazing reward of serving. The reward of serving. The Bible is clear. God honors those who humble themselves and serve. After washing the disciples' feet, Jesus said some very, very powerful words. He says this in John 13. "Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them." Notice what he did not say. He didn't say, "You'll be blessed if you consider doing them." He didn't say, "You'll be blessed if you talk about doing them, or if you tell others that they should do them." He said, "Blessed are you if you do them. Blessed are we if we do them." True servanthood releases joy. Some of the most joyful people I know have the most servant heart. Put it to the test. Try it for yourself. Serving others brings joy. Think of a candle lighting another candle. We had the candlelight service here at Christmas Eve. As one candle lights another candle, that first candle, its flame doesn't go out because the other candle is lit. No, but all together, they grow brighter. It multiplies. And that's what serving does. When we give ourselves away, God fills us and others with joy. Again, let's look at Scripture and see what Jesus said. In Matthew 23, verse 11, we read this. "The greatest among you will be your servant." God reverses the scoreboard. He reverses the whole mindset of the culture of the world. We think the greatest are those who have climbed the ladder of success the highest. The world celebrates celebrities, but God celebrates servants. The world notices titles, but God notices towels. History remembers many famous leaders, but some of the greatest servants are almost unknown. Serving in your community or in your church probably won't get you recognition, but it will touch lives for the glory of God. In heaven, those acts of quiet service are never forgotten. That's what Hebrews 6 tells us, where it says, God is not unjust. He will not forget your work and the love you have shown him as you have helped his people and continue to help them. The reward of servanthood includes joy from living like Christ, influence that impacts lives, and eternal recognition from God. That's quite a list. Looks like servanthood is a pretty smart choice. Servanthood may look small while here on this earth, but it echoes in eternity. Let's bring it all home. Return to that opening picture, that opening scene that I was creating for you, that banquet hall that was just so elegant. All those honored guests that were dressed to the nines. Then the towel and the basin. But now imagine something else. Now imagine after Jesus washes every disciple's feet, he stands up and he looks at them and he says, I did this as an example for you. You will be blessed if you do it. In other words, Jesus didn't serve just so that we could watch him serve or just learn a lesson from him about serving. Jesus invites us to serve with him. I've got a video for us this morning that I want us to see. It was really the beginning of, well, I can't say the beginning, but God used this person named Gail Sayers. He was a very, very famous football player to really spark a whole movement under this title of I Am Third. Look at how God used him.
Left side. Here's a pitch back. It goes to Sayers. He's caught on the goal line, gets away at the 5, the 10. He's still racing. They go all the way, the 30, 35, 40. He's all the way, the 40, 35, 30, 20, 15, 10, 5. Touchdown, Gail Sayers.
Gail Sayers, who played for the Chicago Bears back in the 1960s, ranks among the greatest running backs in the history of professional football. In fact, in a recent ranking, Pro Football Hall of Fame running back Gail Sayers came in at number 22 on NFL Films Top 100 Greatest Players of All Time. Around his neck, Sayers always wore a gold medal, about the size of a loonie. On it were inscribed three words, I am third. Those three words became the title of his best-selling autobiography. The book explains why the words meant so much to Gail. They were the motto of his track coach, Bill Easton, back when he was at the University of Kansas. Coach Easton kept the words on a little sign on his desk. One day, Gail asked Coach Easton what the words meant. Easton replied, "The Lord is first, others are second, and I am third." And as time passed, Gail made those words his own philosophy of his life. And in his second year with the Bears, Gail decided he wanted to wear something meaningful around his neck, like a religious medal. So he bought a gold medal and had the words, "I am third," engraved on it. In his autobiography, Gail says, "I tried to live by the saying on the medal. I don't always succeed, but having the saying around my neck keeps me from straying from it too far.
You may never achieve the notoriety of a Gale Sayers, but if you'll live by this motto, I am third, and purpose in your heart that you will live humbly and serve others, I guarantee you God will use you to touch many people's lives, and that will have a ripple effect far beyond what you could possibly imagine. Let me leave you with some practical steps this week. First, notice needs. Servants pay attention. They are intentionally looking. Ask God to help you see opportunities that other people miss. Choose humility. Do something helpful that no one else wants to do, that needs to be done, maybe that nobody else is even thinking about. Thirdly, serve quietly. Resist the urge to announce your service. Don't tell anyone. Let it remain between you and God. And fourth, serve like Jesus. Serve whether people deserve it or not. Anyone can return an act of kindness. That's really not serving. It's good, don't get me wrong, but this is not true servanthood. Don't wait for someone to deserve your act of kindness. Do it even if they don't. In closing, in many churches, there are two kinds of people. Some arrive asking, well, what's the church going to do for me today? Others arrive asking, who can I care for today? Who can I pray for today? Who can I encourage today? Who can I pray for? Who can I serve? The first group attends church. The second group, they are the church. Which group are you in? Those who attend or those who are the church? When the Spirit of God prompts you to serve, whether it's helping a neighbor, volunteering in ministry, encouraging a hurting friend, praying with somebody, or doing a humble task, don't respond with, who, me, a servant? Instead, say, yes, Lord, hand me a towel. Because the path to true greatness always begins on our knees. Would you stand? Our gracious and loving